Quick announcement before we begin. I don't have firm dates yet, but I'm planning on trying to take off towards the end of May and the first part of June. I believe May the 25th is a Sunday, and thinking about leaving that afternoon and then being gone till the following Thursday. So if you want to plan ahead, that's when I'm going to try to plan time off. So try to let you know as much as in advance so you can make intelligent plans. So you can exercise, you know, your prudence and look ahead, like we're teaching here. Okay, let's make sure that you're in fellowship here and rebound if necessary. And continue on here. We're dealing with the wisdom and its associated benefits, like prudence and foresight and discernment. And 23 is where we are ready to resume here. Further, wisdom protects those that have it by identifying the types of people and situations that one should avoid. In that regard, the doctrine of separation is an indispensable complement to wisdom. And in fact, we have to recognize that certain places just aren't good, you know. They aren't known for being wise places for believers to be. Certain people, it's just not good to associate with. We teach our children this from pretty early on. We tell them to avoid certain places, don't go there. The laws force them not to go certain places until they're 18. So we tell them to stay away from certain people, certain troublemaking types at school and all that, that they're not good for them. Well, God obviously looks out for his children and does the same sort of thing, and wisdom provides you the understanding here to avoid certain situations. The first one, chapter 2 in Proverbs, verses 12 through 15, is the evil man. Again, this comes out of discretion will guard you to deliver you from the way of evil, the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in darkness, who delight in doing evil and rejoice in the perversity of evil, and whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. Again, certain people are underhanded, they're sneaky, they have hidden agendas, they are promoting. You may not see them, but you would be wise to step back and examine things carefully in order to avoid these types of people. Certainly the criminal element is one you would want to avoid. This is one of the benefits of wisdom, is to protect you from the criminal element. As it points out back in chapter 1, the criminal entices people. As it says, this is in verse 10, my son, if sinners entice you, sinners is to be understood there in the terms of the criminal element. Let us lie in wait for blood and ambush the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole. And we will find all kinds of precious wealth. We will fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot with us that we will have one purse. That's always wise, really, to get in with criminals and trust them with your money. They are not trustworthy. That's the whole point. Do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path. The places they frequent, you ought to avoid. And we certainly know that the criminal element frequents certain places. And so we try to avoid those places. It's wise. It's not saying that certain places you shouldn't even be in the first place. I mean, I just can't imagine any believer seeking to rationalize going to the Cheetah Club as something God might want for their lives. I think God wants me to watch women dance naked today. Well, I mean, I don't know how you get to that rationalization, because he doesn't. But certain other places are, we might say, even borderline. Certain bars and certain types of places like that are, unfortunately, they're bad news. You've got freedom in Christ to go there, but the question is, does wisdom dictate that you might stay away from there? Certain places are known for certain things. And again, certain of them are just flat out sinful, and you should avoid them at all costs and at all times. But others of them are maybe less obvious, but can still be sources of trouble and places of trouble. They don't call them bar fights because they happen at church. You don't find, you know, your high quality women typically hanging out there. I love these. I see these. Sometimes I go down 301 there and I see these ads, couples night. Yeah, I'm sure that's what my wife wants to do. Let's go to the nudie bar, honey. I'm sure every wife would just jump on that bandwagon right away. Say, hey, yeah, that sounds fun. You know, Sarasota's got a lot of culture, but that isn't it. There's a lot of cultural events, but I think I would avoid that one. So, you know, certain things, certain places, you just, you know, it's wise to avoid, to think about, and even though you've got freedom, use it wisely. You don't want to get yourself into trouble. Proverbs, the same chapter there, chapter 2, back to that one, 16 through 19, deliver you from the strange woman, from the adulteress who flatters with her words. The strange woman is any woman that's not right woman. And the point is that there's essentially basically what we might call fornication, and then there's adultery. Both are sexual sins. Both are to be avoided. That leaves the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. And we're not just talking about women, quote, who've made mistakes and have moved on with their lives and all of that. That's one of the dangers of self-righteousness and all of that and legalism. People make mistakes. Okay. Fine, they've made a mistake. Now, if they're positive and they get back with Bible class and they get their act together, well, that mistake needs to be forgiven, forgotten, and you just move on with it. We're talking about people here. She not only leaves the companion of her youth, verse 17, she forgets the covenant of her God. We're talking about a woman that's involved in religious reversionism as well, that this isn't just a woman who's made a mistake. Not that we're, again, promoting adultery. We're not. But certainly, there's that isolated incident that could happen. And it happened in David's life. Solomon never committed adultery because he just married them all. He didn't have to. Just marry and move into the castle here and you'll be fine. Or the palace, rather. He didn't probably have a castle, but still. Did he have an adulterous heart? Well, probably. I mean, you know, did he commit adultery? Well, technically, no. It's not that we know of. He had wives and concubines, and so, you know, I've never committed adultery. I just have 40 women I keep. Well, in his case, 1,000. But at any rate, this woman here, again, the adulteress, her house sinks down to death, and her tracks lead to the dead. There were many warnings, again, about, and people can argue this, and I've heard these arguments. Well, this was just a patriarchal society. It was run by men, and so women are denigrated in these verses and all of that. They're denigrated. A certain type of woman is denigrated. First, it's not women in general. Women in general are not denigrated by the Bible. But certain types of women are, that you are to avoid. In wisdom, young men are notoriously stupid. I mean, watch 2.5 Men. Watch Charlie. He exemplifies the stupid young man. If you haven't seen it, there's a lot of people like that. Kids are notoriously dumb when it comes. Young men are notoriously stupid when it comes to females of the species. Once those hormones kick in, you know, they can fall for about anything. And you hear, you know, all these stories, these horror stories of things that happen because people didn't exercise any discernment or discretion. Got involved with the wrong person, you know, that movie like the Black Widow type, you know, she gets married and then kills the guy and gets all the money. Does this repeatedly. So that's the type, you know, the Black Widow type woman, yeah, you want to avoid her pretty much. It might not work out for you. And then Proverbs 6:12, and there's a warning, you know, to stay away from this, to avoid this. This is a sin that has ramifications. Potentially deadly ramifications. You get caught committing adultery, you may get killed. I would defend the guy's right to shoot you in the head. You know, that's the laws of the land prevail in that regard. But legitimate jealousy and all of that, God is very serious about this. 6:12, a worthless person, a wicked man, is one who walks with a perverse mouth, who winks with the eyes, who signals with his feet, who points with his fingers, who with perversity in his heart continually devises evil. Therefore, who spreads strife. Therefore, his calamity will come suddenly. And you don't want to be in his periphery when this comes to pass. That's the whole idea, is that if you're not separated from this type of person, when his calamity comes, it may touch you as well. He will be broken, and there will be no healing. Also, Proverbs 14:7. So certain people, again, you have to have some wisdom, some doctrine. And you can't use, now this is one of the other things, you can't use the doctrine of separation to get you out of unpleasant situations with the idea that, well, okay, I can use this for that. For instance, you can't use separation, as we pointed out when we were teaching Timothy, you can't use separation as a way to get out of taking care of your aged parents. Oh, well, they're negative. I got to separate from them. Well, yes, they may be negative. You may have to separate from them. But do you still have financial obligations towards them? Yes. That's the whole honor. Father and mother has a financial, and in fact, the financial element in that is the priority. It's not the mentally honoring them. It's to take care of them if they need help and they need it. So you can't use separation to get away from that. You can't say, well, my wife's negative, she's an idiot, so I can divorce her under separation. No, you can't. That doesn't follow. That's not an appropriate application of this doctrine. But again, you have to be wise and shrewd with respect to people and to see them for what they are. Verse 7, leave the presence of a fool, or you will not discern the words of knowledge. The wisdom of the sensible is to understand his way, but the foolishness of fools is deceit. And then the last one, 22:24. So, again, separation is one of those doctrines. It's not always pleasant for people. Some people don't like it. More people have probably peeled off a doctrine over this single doctrine than anything else. But again, in certain cases, I do recognize this doctrine has been abused. It's been used as a club. And that's not the purpose of it. 22:24. Do not associate with a man given to anger, or go with a hot-tempered man, or you will learn his ways and find a snare for yourself. So again, the doctrine of separation is an indispensable complement to this. You have to be discerning with regard to people and situations, places, and all of that. 24, in the first half of verse 12, he uses a minimal sentence, which says, wisdom is protection, money is protection. That's the English translation here. The Hebrew literally says, like a shade, or in shade, rather. Under shade, wisdom. Under shade, money. 25, money is certainly a protection when one encounters things in life that require money. In that regard, money provides the financial means for navigating this life. 26, although Solomon has already indicated that money will not provide any lasting satisfaction, he now acknowledges that it does have a relative advantage. Proverbs 5:10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Now, if you take that verse and try to isolate on that and say, well, then therefore, see, money has no value. No, that's not true. Again, you can't isolate on certain verses and jump to far-reaching conclusions that can't be documented with other verses. We recognize that people who pursue money in the details of life are never satisfied at a certain level, no matter how much they get. They're constantly in this. They're constantly looking for the next big deal, the next big sale, the next thing they're going to want. And again, obviously, money provides certain nice things in life. And it does have some value. But will it make people happy? No, that's not where its value lies. Its value is not providing satisfaction or contentment in life. And he who loves abundance will not be satisfied with his income. Now, this is vanity. Well, 27, money can provide the ability to shield oneself from the more harsh realities of life. That money can protect you at a certain level. There's a level at which money cannot protect you. Money can't protect you from a life-threatening illness. No matter how much money you got in the bank, you can't just wish it away. You can't buy yourself out of that one. Again, money, some people, again, suffer in life because they don't have money. They experience here, point 27, money can provide the ability to shield oneself from the more harsh realities of life, which are experienced by those that lack resources. So, is money good? Can it provide a place to live? Sure, or you can live in a cardboard box. Cardboard boxes won't cost you anything. You can go pick one up at Sam's. Is money good to have when you need certain things? Yeah, absolutely. It's good to have money if you want to eat, I think. If you find the place that's giving away the free food all the time. And there are some places that help the down and out and all of that with food. But is that really where you want to eat every day? Well, some people do. Because they don't have any money. 28, money can provide necessities like a house and utilities. a car and fuel. Even living here, you know, I've been down in Key West when it got actually fairly cold once. And there are a bunch of people that live on the street down there. I mean, it's a hotbed for that because it's generally so pleasant. So, but is it better to have, you know, heating oil or a heater and an air conditioner to shield oneself from the harsh realities of weather? Sure. Of course it is. It makes things a lot more comfortable. Car and fuel. I mean, you can have a nice car, but if you can't afford gas for it, which, it, you know, won't be too long until you probably won't be able to. But, you know, money comes in real handy at that gas pump. You know, you can't get it any other way. Clothing, that's always nice to have, you know, beats going naked, and particularly shelter, you know, clothing obviously can be, you know, decorative and all that. You can have nice clothing, but it's not designed to be, quote, real functional. But, you know, some clothing is just functional, sweaters and coats when it's cold, and all of that. Dental and medical care, you know, if you got a toothache, it's pretty handy to have money to go to the dentist. And if you have a problem, it's pretty handy to have money to pay the doctor bill if you need to go see a doctor, if you catch some bacteria or something. Doctors can't help you much with viruses, but they can help you with bacterial things. Or you cut yourself, you know, and lay your finger open to the bone. It's nice to have somebody to stitch it up rather than lose your finger. So, again, medical care, and it can also provide non-essentials that make life more comfortable and enjoyable. You know, I recognize that, like we're talking about, having HBO is a non-essential, but it's nice to be able to watch certain things. You know, you don't have to have a DVR, but it's nice. I don't have to watch. I don't have to tape in. I don't have to watch anything if I don't want to. I can tape it and watch it later. I say tape it, you know, it just shows my technical, you know, genius there. You record it, I suppose. That's more technically accurate. But then I can watch it whenever I want to. Well, that's nice, sure. Yeah, it makes my life. See, when I have, you know, if I have to go outside and work out, or if I have to go outside and work in the yard, or take care of the car, or do this or that, well, then I'm not, okay, my show's on, I got to stop doing this. No, I can order my life around getting my priorities done first, getting my study done. Oh, there's a show on while I'm studying, I can't study now. That's not very good for a pastor. But I recognize that there's a difference between essentials and non-essentials. And money provides both of these. So it does have a relative place in life, a relative advantage. 29, lest anyone think that Solomon is advancing the thinking, that money and wisdom are of equal importance, he adds an assertion about wisdom in the last half of verse 12, which clearly elevates the value of wisdom over the value of money. 30, most of the time when he has used the term yethrone, edge or advantage, or its related term yother there, it has been used to express the reality that Solomon has found no advantage. Typically, that's the way he's used the word. And again, there's only been a couple of cases here. There's only, I think, four total in the whole book where he says that certain things are a positive advantage. And wisdom is the big one. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Well, at the end of it all, at the end of the day, when he dies, of course, any advantage that he might have gained is lost. Does he have a relative advantage as he goes? Is it an advantage to take pleasure in your work and enjoy it? Well, sure, it's a relative advantage. What do you get for all your work? If you get a paycheck, that's a relative advantage to working. But, again, when you die, all those paychecks amount to nothing, essentially. All the pleasure you took in your work amounts to nothing. Also, chapter 2, verse 11, thus I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Solomon said, at the end of it all, I didn't have any edge. I didn't have any real advantage in all that I'd done. And he'd done everything. Now, some might say, well, sure, there's some advantages. He built these beautiful parks. They were nice to look at. They were easy on the eyes and all of that. And this was nice for the animals. I mean, you had this animal preserves that he would build and things he would do like that. And so was there an advantage to it? He said, well, at the end of it all, I say no, there's not. He said there was no advantage to him at any rate. Also, chapter 3, verse 9. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? The suggested answer there is, well, nothing. Not really. Again, you get a relative advantage, you get a paycheck, which has some relative advantages, and it can provide, you know, necessities and luxuries. But again, the bottom line of all of this, of course, at the end of the day, everybody dies and loses whatever advantage they had. 31, verse 12 here contains the third of the four times in this book when he does state that something has a positive advantage. 32, the first dealt with the advantage of having authorities in the establishment chain of command, while the latter three deal with the advantage of wisdom. You got one in our verse, verse 12, verse 11, actually was the first one, and that's Yother, again, the related term. Wisdom is good with an inheritance and an advantage to those who see the sun. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of its possessors. Knowledge has a greater advantage than money in that regard. And then the last time he uses it is in 10:10, in a positive sense at any rate. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. If the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. I'm pretty sure that's right. And if the cobra hits you right between the eyes before you succeed in, you know, winning him over, not much advantage in that. So the idea here is wisdom has some real advantages in that clearly here, like say in chapter 10, he's talking about very fundamental physical things in life where if people would stop and use some sense, they would be further ahead in the game. But again, some don't. That's the whole idea. He who quarries stones in verse 9 may be hurt by them. Yeah, it's pretty easy. If one of them falls on you, you're in trouble. He who splits logs may be endangered by them. So again, you have to be wise or you can very possibly get hurt. And if you're going to be successful, it certainly serves you to be wise. Make your life, it makes it a little bit easier to know to stop and sharpen your axe rather than to continue to cut with a dull axe. Well, 33, one very clear grammatical difficulty in the second half of verse 12. Concerns the use of the term da'ath, knowledge, and how it is related to the subject of wisdom. Many explanations have been offered. Well, I say many, there's primarily two, but many have in terms of amending the text, including amending the text in any number of ways for which there is no good reason. 35, the second is to understand the nouns as a genitive string rather than amending the text is their first option. The second option is to see it as a genitive string as reflected in the New American Standard. 36, if it is understood as a genitive string, the terms knowledge and wisdom would then be little more than synonyms. And you see that in certain situations where, again, you want to be as technically accurate as you can. But one of the dangers that I have observed in exegetes is that they sometimes make distinctions where distinctions don't exist because they're trying to be so technically accurate. And again, that's fine. Their accuracy is good. But when you see things that aren't there, we call that hallucination where I come from. And some exegetes simply hallucinate. And that's not good. Verses 10 here through 11, give me now wisdom and knowledge. Now, what's the big distinctions there between the two things? That I may go out and come in before these people, before this people, for who can rule this great people of yours? And God said to Solomon, because you had this in mind and did not ask for riches, wealth, or honor, or the life of those who hate you. And you have not even asked long life, but you have asked for yourself wisdom and knowledge that you may rule my people, over whom I have made you king. Wisdom and knowledge have been granted to you. And I will also, I guess part of the deal is, God's impressed with this, and blesses Solomon with other things. I will give you riches and wealth and honor, such as none of the kings who were before you has possessed, nor those who will come after you. And some argue, well, this is no big deal because there was only one king in Israel or two before Solomon, and that was Saul and David. He's not just limiting, it doesn't say just kings of Israel. He says kings, and that means all kings. And there were some kings that had some pretty tremendous empires in history. So there it's used in what appears to be nothing much more than synonymous parallel terms. Ecclesiastes 1:16 also. Where I didn't see any huge distinction between them here. Again, they are not probably strict synonyms, but they, in some cases they may be. Behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were in Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. Obviously, I think knowledge would probably be more credited or dealt with the specific technical aspects of facts and figures, of knowing things. And wisdom is how to figure out how to use those, that knowledge to your best interest and in your best interest and to the best benefit. So again, but if they're seen as wisdom and knowledge here, knowledge and wisdom, they would be a little more than synonyms. 37, another possibility is recognizing the form da'af as the same form as the cal infinitive, which would yield the sense that it is an advantage to recognize, i.e. to know, that wisdom preserves the life of its owner. And the advantage is in knowing that wisdom has a benefit that money doesn't have. Money can't, in the long term, in the big scheme of things, money can't protect you indefinitely. It can only protect you in certain areas. It's limited. Whereas wisdom apparently has a much more broad ability to protect people. So 38, in either case here, and I tend to lean towards the 37 point, to see this as an infinitive, it's an advantage to recognize. And why is it an advantage to recognize? Because it's an advantage for you to figure out that wisdom is the more valuable of the two things. So in either case, the intent of Solomon is to point out, it doesn't, again, materially affect the interpretation here, what's Solomon trying to say? He's trying to say wisdom is better than money, even though they both have relative advantages. He's trying to point out the superior value of wisdom to the relative value of money, since wisdom offers something that money cannot. 39, one interpreter, and perhaps others, have completely missed the point and attempt to interpret the statement as one of skepticism, which asserts that wisdom is no more reliable than money in the final analysis. Not real clear how I came up with that. Again, that's very creative exegesis, but I don't see any way from the text to yield that conclusion. But maybe I'm not creative enough. I don't know. 40, nevertheless, the verse clearly indicates that wisdom can provide something money cannot. Wisdom can preserve the life of those who have it. 41, the Hebrew term kaya is used in a number of ways, which include the most basic meaning of living or having life. From there, the meaning is broadened to include the senses of giving or even restoring life. 42, when it is used in the PL stem, it has the nuance of preserving life. And that sense is reflected well here by the New American Standard. To preserve something alive is to keep it alive. Genesis 7:3, and the narrative with respect to the flood of Noah. He says you're going to take animals by sevens, and also the birds of the sky, verse 3, by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive, to preserve them alive is the idea. On the face of all the earth. And Exodus 1:17 also uses a PL there in the similar sense of preserving life as opposed to, say, giving life. Exodus 1:17. And this gets into the midwives. This king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives and said, when these women are giving birth, if it's a son, you put him to death. You just kill him on the spot. And if it's a daughter, you let her live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the kingdom of Egypt had commanded them. They translate here, but let the boys live. The idea was preserve them alive, kept them alive in that context. And, of course, the king of Egypt figures this out, Pharaoh, figures this out and calls them on the carpet for it. But God blesses them and honors them, and they sort of provide, you know, some sort of half-hearted explanation that he accepts. Probably here, sanctified lying. People don't like to hear about that. Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. Well, that part was probably true. They're not. For they are vigorous, and they give birth before the midwife can get to them. Well, that's not true. They'd gotten to them, and to say they'd seen them give birth to males that they didn't kill. That part's not true. So God was good to the midwives. See, this, people start getting, you know, then now you're on a slippery slope, sanctified lying. Well, yes, and when we're talking about issues of life and death and murder, let's see, does God want me to murder or lie? Probably prefer that you lie and not kill innocent babies. And we're not talking, we're talking people who had come to birth that God had given life. So it would have been murder. He wasn't telling them, you know, to generate stillbirths or to cause abortions. He was saying, once they've been born, you kill them. And that's a huge difference. There's a huge moral difference there. So the idea here, another case of sanctified lying was seen in Rahab the hooker. She lied to her own people because she was positive and helped the Jews and saved them alive, protected them, because they would have been killed. But in both cases that I've seen of sanctified lying, I haven't seen too many incidents of it in the Bible. Probably these two are the only two I remember. Not to say there aren't more, but it was in life and death situations that, you know, murder. And as a matter of fact, speaking of life and death situations, I was watching, if any of you watch House, I like him because he's arrogant. And he knows everything, or if he doesn't know it, he's sure to make you think he does. They had a morals issue on one of the ones recently. This guy was, he told him, I'm terminal, I'm dying, and he was, as it turned out. But until they knew he was dying, they weren't willing to help him die. There was this big moral issue of, and one of the women in the show, she wanted it both ways. She was mad at House because he wasn't willing to kill him, but she didn't want to help him continue to research the matter because the guy said, no, I just want to die, leave me alone. I don't want any more tests, which he has no moral right to say. Again, it raised some moral questions with respect to life and how you have to deal with it. And so one of the deals was House pretended he was, you know, giving him morphine to kill him so he could go out. And he was really just putting him in a coma so he could figure out what was wrong with him. So she was mad because he put him in a coma to try to save his life, but she was mad if he was going to kill him. Well, you can't have it both ways. You either have to either try to preserve the life or kill it, one or the other. So anyway, that was one of those deals there where it was a moral issue. They brought it up and sort of explored it. And he put him into a coma and continued to try to figure out what was wrong with him. And he finally did figure out what was wrong with him, and he was terminal. So then, you know, but he didn't go in and put him to death because the guy was begging him, give me morphine and kill me, put me out. So 43, since it is I don't like House in that he's obviously an atheist too, because he told him there's nothing after death. So I don't like that. See, I don't get excited about these shows and get all enamored with the characters because they all have some serious doctrinal issues, flaws. 43, since it is parallel with the idea of shadow or protection, it indicates that wisdom is able to protect the one that has it from premature death or calamity. Proverbs 3:2. And this brings up an issue that the scriptures seem to set forth pretty plainly. And that is that through stupidity, you can shorten your life. Obviously, now God knew that you were going to be so stupid that you would shorten your life. So it's no big surprise to him. But apparently, some people could live longer with wisdom. Proverbs 3:2, for length of days and years of life and peace, wisdom adds to you. And verse 16, long life is in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. And verse 18, she is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all those who hold her fast. And one of the things we'll see coming up here is that it appears that people can shorten their life through their stupidity. And some can, we might say, from the human viewpoint, lengthen their life by their evil. Coming up here in chapter, as a matter of fact, it's in this chapter. If you look down about verse 15, there is a righteous man who perishes in, and I would translate this in spite of his righteousness, not in his righteousness. I think they've kind of missed a little bit of the interpretative point there. He perishes in spite of his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in spite of his wickedness. And so then Solomon, you know, we'll get into, is he advocating the golden mean here? A little wickedness, a little righteousness. You know, try not to be too good, try not to be too bad. And then if you look on into chapter 8, it says here, although verse 12, a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, I know it will be well for those who fear God and fear him openly. But it won't be well, again, for the wicked. But he says, you know, I keep seeing these things that are opposite what I would expect to see knowing God's nature. As he says in verse 14, there's a futility. There are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say this is futility. So again, Solomon wrestles with some of these difficult matters in life and some of these things that we can't always figure out and rationalize. But it appears that, again, a person can shorten their life through wickedness. In verse 17, he says, do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Insinuating, at least, implying that wickedness can shorten your life through your own stupidity. And folly and all of that, being a fool, making bad choices. Well, we could see how making certain bad choices might shorten your life. You make bad choices to hang out with the wrong people, and something goes wrong, and you end up getting caught in a gunfight. Well, that could shorten your life, obviously. Okay, well, let's move on here. Verse 13, God's sovereignty over life. And in spite of all these other observations, he continues to come back to the point that there is a sovereign God behind all this. That God is oversees all of this, whether people see it, acknowledge it, or not. Consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? You actually have the Cal imperative here. It's a command of Ra'ah. And it means, the word Ra'ah means to see or to look at. And the idea here is, look at this, consider this. And likely it's not much different, say, than the interjection, hine, behold. Behold, look at this, see this. It has the idea. Look at this. And they translated it, consider. The work is the sign of the direct object, which is just E-T-H in the Hebrew. The work is ma'aseh, M-A-apostrophe-A-S-E-H. This word means work or activity, masculine singular noun construct, actually. The activity, and actually what you have here, and this is a good thing in Hebrew grammar to pick up, when you have a construct chain in the second, the one not in the construct, the one that follows, has a definite article, it makes the whole phrase definite. And so they've rightly translated it here, the work of God, although the work is not, doesn't have the definite article. It's an arthrous. So consider the work of God. For, they've translated conjunction key here, that, for, or because. Because who, interrogative pronoun me, M-I-Y, who is able, Cal imperfect, second masculine singular, Yakol, Y-A-K-H-O-L, who is able, who has the strength, and then this word takes a complementary infinitive, to straighten. You got the PL infinitive construct with the attached prefix lamed, and the verb is takan, T-A-Q-A-N. It's only used three times and only used in Ecclesiastes. And this word means to become straight or to make straight. Who is able to straighten? You got the sign of the direct object. What is the relative particle here, asher? Who is able to straighten that which he has made crooked? The PL perfect. Again, the PL, because these words aren't used a whole lot, but generally the PL is viewed as an intensive stem. But if it's not used in the Cal, that distinction doesn't always exist. So the idea would be, who would be able to perfectly straighten what he has completely bent, we might say. You got the PL perfect, third masculine singular, plus the third masculine singular suffix, sort of a redundant suffix. Who is able to straighten that which he has bent it? if in the Hebrew, if you have the, you translate the suffix literally. And then you've got this verb, awath, A-W-A-T-H. Again, the word means literally to make crooked or bend. Figuratively, it's used in business to cheat or to pervert something. In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider. God has made one as well as the other. In the day is a prefixed inseparable preposition bait plus the masculine singular noun of yom for day. In the day of good. Tov here, again, you see the broad way this word is used. They've translated it here, prosperity. In the day of good times, blessing, obviously. Prosperity might be a part of that. But you have good days. You know what he's talking about when you hear this phrase, a good day. In the good day, we might say. And then you got a cal imperative, masculine singular of hayah, H-A-Y-A-H, and that is the verb to become. Become in good, literally. You got the inseparable preposition bait with the masculine singular noun tov. In other words, enjoy the good. Whatever, and they've translated prosperity because it seems to me that very often in the New American Standard, they've looked at this as though it has more of a financial component. There are a lot of things that make life good. Is money one of them? Well, yeah, but there, you can have a good life without money. I've had times when I was completely broke and I wasn't miserable because I didn't have any money. What causes life to be good? Well, that we just know that sometimes life is good. And we've all said that. Life is good. And why is life good? Well, we have these days, times, periods, where it is. And a bunch of factors kind of factor into that to make it so. And it isn't just money. So that's the only point I want to make here is that they say prosperity, but it's not just financial. You have emotional prosperity. That's when you're really happy. The idea here is become with the good, literally. Enjoy yourself. And the same construction is used, for instance, in Psalm 25:13. Become in the good or with the good. And again, I just want you to understand that, again, prosperity doesn't just focus on money. And that tends to be what the idea sometimes I think people get. His soul will abide in good. In prosperity is the way they've translated it here. And it's also used there in Ecclesiastes 2:1. Same construction. And I believe it's the so enjoy yourself, be in good, if I remember right in that one. Matter of fact, I can check that. Ecclesiastes 2:1. Yeah, see, and literally it's see with goodness or in good. The idea here is to enjoy it. So in the day of prosperity, enjoy yourself. See, some people say, well, this is bad advice. No, this is good advice. This is real good advice. If you're not happy in the day of prosperity, you're an idiot. I mean, good Lord, if you can't be happy when things are good, I mean, there's probably people like that out there. In the good day, enjoy it. If it's going your way, hey, kick back, relax, and enjoy it. And this is so, again, opposite to some of the teachings that I've heard over the years. That, you know, there's no place for happiness, there's no place for enjoyment. If you were applying doctrine, you'd never be happy. The opposite is true, of course. So in the day of prosperity, enjoy it. And in the day of evil, you got a wow here, plus the inseparable preposition bait again, plus yom and day. And then you got ra'ah, R-A-A-H, apostrophe A-H. Evil, the word here, ra'ah, evil, calamity, distress. And they've translated here with adversity, which is good, because it's not necessarily that something evil's happened to you, but something's pressuring you. You have days where there's no pressure and you're enjoying life, and you have days where you got lots of pressure. And in the day of adversity, consider, again, you've got the cal imperative of ra'ah. Look at this. Again, probably not much different than the interjection hint at. See this. God has made the one as well as the other. You got the conjunction here, gam. Also, or indeed, even, you know. Then what you got, the sign of the direct object. This one. Sign of the direct object is zet, Z-E-H. And then you have an inseparable preposition plus lamed plus the preposition uma, U-M-M-A-H. Uma means literally over or against or beside. It's designed, the word used is designed to denote relationship of one thing with another. Exactly as, and they've translated it as well as, that indeed, this as well as this, you got another masculine singular. And when you have these two adjectives, zet, used in a string like that, it's often translated this and that. And in here they translate it one and the other, which is fine. That communicates. He's made the day, God has made the day of adversity just as much as he makes the day of prosperity. God's still in charge of both of them. And what do we tend to think? When we're having the hard times, when we're under adversity, well, what's God doing now? Where's God at? Why is he screwing up? And now, he's not screwing up when things are going my way. He's only screwing up when they're not. So this and that, or one and the other, that's fine. Either way you want to translate that there. Calperfect of asa, to make or manufacture. A-S-A-H. As manufactured, the Elohim, the God, made one exactly as he made the other. And for this reason, they've translated it here so that you have the preposition ale with the feminine singular noun construct of divra, D-I-B-H-R-A-H, divra, for this reason or for this purpose or on account of this, you've got the prefix relative particle sheen, which not, literally, we'll find out. We'll find is the idea. You've got the negative low here, plus the verb matzah, cal imperfect, M-A-T-S-A apostrophe. This word means to find out or to figure out something. The word, the simple word means to find, like you know, you're looking for something and you find it. But to find out or to figure out is the idea, the nuance of it here. They've translated it by the word discover, because you know, obviously if you find something, you discover it. Man may not discover. For this reason, will not discover. And then you've got the noun actually here, the definite article with the masculine singular noun, Adam. And he's very consistent through here with the use of Adam. When he uses it with the definite article, we translate it by man, but we mean mankind in this context. See, women can't figure it out either. They're no better off or worse off than men in that regard. So he's talking about the human race. The human race cannot figure out, will not find out what comes after him. And again, or what comes after them, we might say, because we're dealing with the entire race. After him is Acharei. A-C-H-A-R-E-Y, plus the third masculine singular. This is the adverb, and it means behind or after, depending on, spatially it would mean behind, like the wall's behind me. In time, it means after, as in behind me, in the same way. And then you got this masculine singular noun of ma'uma. And this word means anything or nothing. M-E apostrophe U-M-A-H. Man, people, we might say, or the human race, mankind, is not going to figure out what comes after him, anything about it. I mean, once you're gone, you're gone. And the future, even, you know, taking it in the extreme sense, once you die, anything that happens after that's irrelevant to you. But taking it in the more limited sense of the future, you're not going to figure out what the future holds. You're not going to figure out whether it holds prosperity or adversity. And do you really want to know? Or do you just want to deal with it on a day-to-day basis as you have to deal with it? And that seems to be one of the things here. Solomon advocates this sort of, again, take life day by day, enjoy what you have, Don't get too excited over the great things. You be happy in prosperity. But again, I kind of came out of this generation, and I don't know that it was ever taught me per se, but there was always this underlying feeling of never get too happy. Never get too excited about anything, because you can lose it all. I mean, you know, many of our parents lived through the Depression or were born during that time and had, you know, difficult times in life and have seen difficult times and lived through warfare and all of that. And there was sort of, I don't know, there was always this underlying tension that was, it was, I don't know, I don't remember that it was ever expressed, but there was just this sort of deal of don't be too happy. Happiness is dangerous. You don't really want to, you know, you don't want to get too excited. So Solomon says just the opposite, though. He says, hey, if you got a good day, you might as well rejoice in it. Enjoy yourself. There's nothing wrong with it. Okay, well, our time is up, so we will stop there and be ready to dive into this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word today. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us. In Christ's name, amen.